I love Star Trek again. Shut up. After that stupid Castaway episode.
Shore leave.
Now we're back to the Galileo 7, and I loved it.
Well, Mike, I'm glad to hear you're in better voice this time around. Although I don't think shore leave is that terrible. Friends of Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies, we're back. It's Captain Matt Ross with my XO number one, Mike Pontone. I assume you're doing a lot better now that you've seen the Galileo 7 tonight's episode on Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. How you doing, Mike?
Oh, pretty good. Believe it or not. I didn't even tell you this beforehand. I had been signed up for a marathon today for many months, and I swore earlier in the month I was not doing it because I wasn't feeling good. And then I woke up today and I said, I'm going to give it a shot. And I did a marathon today.
Wow.
So my little ankles feel like broken glass, but I'm happy that I did it. And it was a nice little medal.
Well, at least
I'm going to promptly throw out.
Well, at least you didn't crash on Taurus 2 in the middle of a galactic quasar. That's actually pretty good. So
tell me about it.
Tonight's episode
could have been much worse.
Yeah, that's quite true. You could be, instead of going to drop off medical supplies at Marcus 3, you could be sent on a ridiculous science experiment instead. But tonight's episode is the Galileo 7. It talks about a Commander Spock and a crew of six other people on a shuttlecraft exploring a strange green quasar thing in the middle of space. And what happens to them on the way down? So, Mike, did you get a chance to go read the exciting blurb from somewhere on the internet, or shall I read the NBC press release once again?
Let me give you mine. I just pulling this from IMDb, and I'm kind of curious how much it's going to sync up with the press blurb.
Sure.
A shuttlecraft under Mr. Spock's command is forced to land on a hostile planet. His emotionless approach to command does not sit well with some crew members, particularly Mr. Boma, who challenges Spock at every opportunity. The Enterprise and Captain Kirk, meanwhile, have only a short time to find the lost shuttlecraft as they must deliver urgent medical supplies to Marcus III in only a few days. That's about the size of it in a nutshell.
That's pretty is, but the NBC press release of December 20th, 1966 says the severely damaged shuttlecraft from the USS Enterprise threatens to become a tomb for its trapped crew after it crashes on a planet and loses contact with its mothership in the Galileo 7 on NBC's television network colorcast of Star Trek. And what's really funny is that actually the rest of the press release refers to a Dr. Spock. I guess someone was right, either had a pregnant wife or was reading on, childcare. Dr. Spock obviously is the pediatrician or the doctor who talks about children versus Mr. Spock, whom we all know and love and is obviously in Star Trek. But yeah, this is a lot of fun, at least to me this episode is. I assume from your happier tone, you also had a good time with this, correct?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much beautiful, skipping ahead, there's so much beautiful classic Trek here.
Mm-hmm.
The central conflict being the one that will define Spock and Kirk's relationship being how much you sacrifice for the good of the one.
It's also,
in this situation, the good of seven.
That's true. Well, this is also in pure art forms, it's man versus man versus environment, and man versus himself, or person versus themselves, I guess, we're in this modern day and age. But those are all three can be seen here. But it starts off with a weird opening, I find. They are trying to deliver medical supplies that are very needed on Marcus III, and Kirk says, hey, you know what? Let's launch a scientific expedition. I mean, I know it only comes up once, or it's hard to see, but let's do that as opposed to delivering medical supplies. And that's where we meet Commissioner Ferris, who's saying, like, I'm really against that idea.
You just mind your P's and Q's, Buster, and remember who you're dealing with.
I don't know, I thought that was a little bit ridiculous. We've got to deliver medical supplies that are very needed, and later we find out they're desperately needed from Commissioner Ferris, but Kirk says, you know what, screw you, I'm going to send out a scientific expedition. I don't know, something about that annoyed the crap out of me. It always does, but I get past that rather quickly since that's the beginning.
No, I personally actually like that detail quite a bit.
Yeah.
Not to be contrarian, but I like that he said, listen, we've got 5 days to get there. We're going to be there in two. And I have standing orders that as an exploratory vessel, we're supposed to explore quasars. Matt, what is a quasar?
Quasar is a decaying sun that shoots out neutrons at a, or actually that's a neutron star, but they're similar where they shoot out high energy radiation in a specific area. Actually, quasars have been determined not to be found in our immediate vicinity and actually are far away. But that's my understanding of what a quasar is. Why, Mike?
Now, Matt, tell me the second question. How the hell do you know that? See, Matt here is
science!
The big brain. He's the actual one with, he's the one with the science background.
Sort of.
I was a humanities guy. We both ended up becoming attorneys, but Matt's got this big brain that knows this stuff.
That's right. Check out the big brain on Matt.
Check out the big brain on Brad.
But there,
yes.
But, you know, I just like, not to sound like New Trek, I do like science and not in a weird, ironic way. One thing that is interesting on this is the Murasaki 3112 quasar is totally made up. There is no Murasaki quasar, but it sounds like it's really important.
Okay.
Well, that, yeah,
so,
go ahead.
Yeah. No, just, I mean, it didn't have to be a real quasar, just as much as like planets don't have to be real or suns don't have to be real. But I really dug that they went off on an exploratory mission, and I really liked the shuttlecraft Galileo. It's beautiful. Minimalist.
Well, it is, but I want to tell you, though, I want just a quick aside. When they wrote this, this was originally written by a gentleman named Crawford, who was actually one of the, he was a blacklisted writer originally from the 50s because he was accused of communist proclivities. And yeah, so here you can even hear me turning the pages for my notes. But he wrote the original story. But he did not like the fact that the Roddenberry gang kept asking for rewrites for free. So in his second draft, because he heard from other writers about how Star Trek was to do that, he wrote Final. So the story is actually credited to our good friend Winselberg, who put under, again, his pseudonym S. Bar David. That's Shimon Winselberg. He wrote Dagger of the Mind. And again, it was rewritten by Gene Kuhn, who add the humor and the humanity in a lot of Star Trek, like the give and take between characters like Spock and McCoy and Kirk and Ferris.
Yeah, I see.
Ferris.
Winselberg, a good Irish name. So obviously,
yeah,
that's
obviously.
Why he had to do the pseudonym of S. Bar David. Yes, go on.
Well, no, he did it because it consistently got into arguments with Roddenberry over money and also with credit. So that's why he put down S. Bar David. We had covered this earlier in Dagger of the Mind. You must have used your neural neutralizer and clearly forgotten that. But whatever.
You will forget all you have heard.
I do like the shuttlecraft. The shuttlecraft itself is something unique. What did you like about it? I'm just curious.
I like that it was bigger. Style. I like that it was like kind of like a little, seemed like a little submarine. You know, it was very utilitarian, very naval. And my goodness, talk about space. Like, you had a lot more space than the TNG tiny little floating cubicles. But I guess with the TNG cubicles, you also had a teleportation. You know, you had a transporter, and you had warp drive, and a replicator.
But it does depend on which shuttlecraft you're talking about. Some shuttlecrafts from TNG, like the Type 2, were like little tiny things. There was the pods. Then they got bigger and bigger. Then you had, like, the runabouts, which they used in DS9,
and the runabouts made their way to TNG.
Yes, and they got too big, in fact. But the shuttle pods, like this one that Data's in, where they go to a planet with a dam, and that's the Ensigns of Command. It looks like a two-seater. It's the Miata of shuttlecraft.
I like the small TNG shuttlecraft. I actually never like the design for whatever reason. I never liked the design of the runabout on DS9, despite being a DS9 fan.
Well, yeah, that I actually like that one, but the shuttlecrafts from TNG look like giant eggs to me. So,
yes.
But this shuttlecraft, what makes it unique, besides the fact that it was designed by Matt Jeffries, the guy who, like, well, pretty much makes all the ship stuff, they couldn't afford it. It was $12,000 in 1966 dollars, which at that time, if you compute it to today, when you're hearing this, in 2024, that would have been a $115,000 item. The problem with that is if you using today's dollars, each episode cost $1 million. Using a tenth of your budget for just one thing can be quite pricey. And in fact, the end result using 2024 dollars came out to $231,000. Again, on $1 million budget using 20%. That's a lot.
They were freaking out. Well, I will say this. The shuttle, I was thinking of this right off the bat. It looks beautiful. I mean, all the doors sliding, all the little articulations with like the phaser dispenser, the seating, the technical components when they're trying to rework the ship. I mean, and it looked fantastic from the outside. It was obviously a full blown set. So, I mean, money well spent. And were they able to reuse it in later episodes?
Well, that's actually kind of funny the way, here, I'll just give you the quick background on this. Robert Justman, the producer, was freaking out about how much money this was to cost. He says, okay, we'll do it, but we're going to have to amortize it over several episodes. This was actually technically the first appearance of the shuttlecraft, although when you see the menagerie, they're in the shuttlecraft as well. That's because that's the model that they made from this. So what happened was they were trying to figure out how to do it, and the AMT Corporation that makes models and also makes set stuff wanted the exclusive rights to make Star Trek models of the Enterprise and various components. So they said, we'll build you two for free. End of story. So it cost them nothing, and they had two of them. They had one that was just the outside, then they had one with both outside and inside. And then they used little their own staff too at the Star Trek staff made miniatures. There's even, although we are watching the newer version, the enhanced version on Amazon or Paramount, they had a little miniature model and a hangar deck that they made that showed the shuttlecraft taking on and off. So they did that in-house for various thousands, a couple thousand dollars, but still it's a lot for back then. I still think that's some of the best model work there, even though it made the special effects company freak out. But I love the shuttlecraft. I think the original shuttlecraft, by the way, was in some guy's backyard rusting away. But they've since rescued that. It's a great model, and they use it many times in Star Trek, in the original series. So yeah, there's the Galileo, and they go on their mission, and they
now get question
almost yes.
When I was watching it, I was watching the remastered. This is the most seemingly intentional insertions of CGI, because whenever I see the shuttle landing or coming out of the docking bay, it's obviously CGI. How good was the original model looking?
It's actually not that bad. You can actually look for it on YouTube. You can see the original. I mean, they did put it in what's known as a garbage mat, which is a like a separate box to hide wires and so forth. You can see it more clearly if you see the original, if you have just the DVD version, which I happen to have, and you can see that. But it was actually not bad for the time. In fact, the character who plays Mr. Boma thought the special effects were fantastic for 1966. They actually were, I think, pretty damn good in this episode. You know, with the ship going through what it had to go through. But the remaster does add a lot of nice things between the shuttlecraft's demise and what happens to it. But even getting there, the original story, by the way, wanted to have it a lot more complicated. But, you know, money says no.
Wait, what was more complicated? What was supposed to be more complicated?
Well, they wanted to show that they beamed away from the shuttle, that it was broken into several pieces. They wanted to have more shuttle stuff, but
This is better.
You know, yeah, this was, you know, less is more. That's true in many things in life. I just think it was funny. It was almost cliche. Okay, we're like 10 feet away from the Enterprise, and now we're immediately lost. I thought that was pretty hilarious.
I mean, let's talk about the planet. I really like the look of the planet. I really like the fog. I dug there was one scene that was really cool where one of them was descending down and the fog was just like a layer. It reminded me of Alien from the 70s when they descend down, when John Hurt's character, Kane, descends down to the alien egg pit. It looked really good. I guess it's just going to be a problem with early Trek, so I'm going to have my one little criticism for this episode. I kept on expecting an explanation for the giant barbarians. It was like, okay, anything? And then the episode just ends. I kind of forget about them.
Yeah,
but that's basically it.
Well, this is actually based on a 1939 movie called Five Came Back, which stars Lucille Ball in a very serious role, which is funny since she is the main sponsor of Star Trek. But because it's Desilu Productions, her being the Lou. Uh-huh. So in that story, a plane crashes on an island filled with cannibals, and they have to leave several people behind in order to escape. So very similar in that. In fact, the writer originally, Crawford, said that, yeah, I just copy old movies and cop shows and adventures, and I just try and put them in any situation I can. And, well, that one is an adventure escape story, so that's what this came to be. This is actually loved a lot by also by NBC as well. But as to the giant humanoids, when they crash, they hear that there are humanoids there. They're supposed to be like 11 feet tall.
That was pretty well done.
Yeah, but they're not.
I dug that.
But they are good. That's the guy who played it. His name is Robert Big Buck Maffey. He's 7 feet tall. So, wow. But they're supposed to be like primitive. Now, as to the smoke in there, part of it was to make it mysterious, and part of it was to hide the fact that it's a plaster set. But there's another reason too, which is hilarious. Standards and practices did not like the fact that someone got impaled by a spear, so they had to hide the fact that someone got impaled by a spear because, oh no, someone could be dead. Oh no. But
hey, all it takes is a kid to make a gigantic 12-foot spear and try to run his buddy through while they're playing Star Trek.
Sure, let's go watch the news now and watch how we're killing people in Vietnam in between. So, yes.
This is true, yes.
Actually, this was supposed to have a slight parable towards PM to Vietnam because they comment down. Spock says, well, I'm surprised they weren't afraid or impressed by our technology. And McCoy says, well, you know, they weren't like impressed. They were annoyed. So they came after us. And
most illogical reaction. We demonstrated our superior weapons. They should have fled. I mean, they should have respected us. Of course, Mr. Spock, respect is a rational process. Did it ever occur to you they might react emotionally?
Some people picked up on the fact it was the same thing that the combined military might of the United States with its superior weaponry didn't cow the North Vietnamese into submission. So that was actually a very, very allegorical dig at Vietnam. I know you may not think so, but that's actually what it was written as.
No, so. Yeah. I mean, that sounds obviously appropriate, and I didn't even think about that at the time. But yeah, sure. I mean, it's the same thing with one of my favorite sci-fi films of all time, Aliens. James Cameron based it on the same thing. Someone coming in with obviously superior firepower being overwhelmed and killed by a strategically superior force.
Check it out. Hey, Ripley, don't worry. Me and my squad of ultimate badasses will protect you. Check it out. Independently targeting particle beam failings. Fry half the city with this puppy. We got tactical smart missiles, phased plasma pulse rifles, RPGs. We got sonic electronic wall breakers. We got nukes, we got knives, sharp sticks.
Knock it off,
watch it. Hey, speaking of Boma, that guy rocked.
Yes,
Boma. Donald James Marshall?
He's related, Don Marshall. James Marshall is his, I think it was his brother. But he was also in the Land of the Giants for two seasons. Everyone was so impressed with his work that Irwin Allen immediately gave him a job. But he had also been like on the outs with the community because he didn't want to do some African adventure stories where he was like second fiddle to a lion. So, you know, he was blacklisted for a while, but this and Mission Impossible got him back on into the trades. And this also pretty much launched his career. Let's just talk about the crew anyway. We have a bunch of people in here.
Yeah.
This is a more of a character study of Spock, by the way, and his use of logic in view of intense situations. Logic doesn't always work. It was the conflict you had between Scotty, McCoy, Spock, Boma, Gaetano, Latimer, and the new Yeoman of the Week. You know, what did you think of her?
Yeoman Cutie Patootie.
She's supposed to be Rand, by the way. They do everything they can to get rid of Rand.
No, I thought that she was gorgeous. Was she not? She was a different. She was not the same one from last time.
No. This one is Phyllis Douglas. She was actually was very funny. She was in the movie Gone with the Wind, but at age 2. And she was also in several Batmans, and she does come back to Star Trek, but I'm not going to tell you in which episode. A very later episode in the 3rd season. Not my favorite either. But she is, I'll just give you a hint, yay brother, for those of you who are listening to Yelling at Cash's Anomalies. So she's in that. But I actually like the way they all were there. Boma's an astrophysicist, by the way. There's a lot of personal drama on the set. He did not like the director. The director was his acting coach. And the director being Gist, that's his name. He was actually in various things, including Robert Gist was in Operation Petticoat, but he became a director and did various shows like Twilight Zone, The Lieutenant, where he met Roddenberry. Same place where Don Marshall met Roddenberry on the episodes of The Lieutenant. But one of the reasons why Don Marshall did not like Robert Gist is that he said Robert Gist wanted him to be like James Dean from Rebel Without a Cause and always nervous and unsure of himself. And he says, I'm an astrophysicist.
Yeah,
what are you talking about? And so Nimoy talked to the director and he said, I'll take care of it. You act the way you're supposed to. So that's actually pretty cool. So Nimoy was, an actor's actor, I guess you could say.
I mean, fantastic. Absolutely. Because, yes, it's such a good thing. And I guess this is a thing that it's like much more important. They say that, the theater is the actor's medium, film is the director's medium, and television is the writer's medium. But, mm-hmm. Nimoy has pointed out that when you're playing a character for multiple seasons or decades in his, case, with a variety of different directors and writers coming through, it's up to you to be the custodian of your own character. So I think that he might have seen the importance, maybe even back then, doing, 16 episodes so far, but knowing the character of Spock more than anyone else, the importance of giving the actor the actor's voice and characterization import. So, if Boma's actor is making a very fine point that, hey, I'm an astrophysicist, why would I be unsure of myself? It's also, he's a strapping man. He's in his 30s. He's not just some young ensign. Why would he be self-doubting? And that led to the better conflict, that you have him as this powerful emotional force against Spock. And quick aside, Nimoy's playing it perfectly. Logic does not mean emotionless. He's got emotions in this episode. He's just, it's obvious that he's just choosing not to let them rule him, which is what a Vulcan does.
That's exactly right. It's usually misinterpreted that Vulcans have no emotions. It's just that they bury and suppress them, but they actually do. And they do live their lives, though, purely through logic. But emotion may take an import into their decisions. So, Boma mouthing off. I actually like that. A lot of people don't like that, but I understand they're in a desperate situation and Spock saying, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. The actor even said this is one of the rare times, especially in the 60s, having a black man mouth off and not seem like, who the heck is he? He actually Right. made some really excellent points, like who decides who stays and who goes. But I have to be honest with you, it would always probably be the commanding officer. Because, you could order people to their deaths. That's what you have to do. But that was an interesting conflict.
And here's the thing, though, that I dug. He was not disobeying Spock. He's disagreeing with him. At no point does he do something or fail to do something that Spock tells him to do.
That's correct. In fact, none of them do. Well, one other interesting point on this also is that it was in the original script, the engineer would be dead. So Scotty was not scheduled to play any more roles. McCoy at this time, because this, remember, the filming's all over the place, he too could have possibly died. But this was actually, James Doohan remarked that this was his actual, really enjoyed working with Nimoy in other episodes of like Twilight Zone, etc. So they got to work more full time in this, but they liked Scotty so much they kept him. And Doohan did comment that he spent most of his time down on the floorboards in that little cavity trying to fix the engines. I actually like that whole little bit where he's very engineering in this. Would you think of Scotty as our engineer?
Yeah, great. You know, again, we don't really have much characterization of Scotty or Uhura or Sulu. And I'm assuming that that comes later.
Yeah, it's later. It's later. But I like him in this episode. He does seem to know what the heck he's doing. So that's what I do like that. But yeah, the main star of the show is not Shatner on the bridge of the Enterprise, having Ferris tell him, "You now have 2 days left. You now have 24 hours left. You now have two hours left."
Commence countdown.
10 minutes and counting.
9 minutes and counting. 8 minutes and counting.
7 minutes and counting.
6 minutes and counting.
5 minutes and counting.
By the way, the actor playing Commissioner Ferris did not like the fact that it wasn't the director telling him where to go. It was actually Shatner telling him where to go. I think that's
why is that?
Well, because Shatner was telling him where to stand, where to sit, and the director was assuming that he was a new director relatively. He was assuming he was working with these people again. He was afraid to contradict the main star. So I think that's actually a little bit of an intrigue over there. But for direction of where to stand and sit, I don't see a big deal. Lean here, lean there. You know, I'm going to say get over it. Because
I will say I wasn't crazy about that.
You didn't like Commissioner Ferris in his cape jacket?
No capes.
I thought he looked pretty cool, actually. And I was like, oh, this guy was a Western guy. And I looked him up and like, yes, lots of Westerns.
Yes.
Again, good show, very good episode. My whole thing is just like they have the same conversation 3 times.
They did.
They're like, we have to go. I'm waiting. We have to go. I'm waiting. Like, you know how important this is? Yes, I'm going to go as soon as I can, which I understand. You have to keep bouncing back a little bit. It's difficult to balance a B story and have it be exciting but also meaningful.
Well, I still think they could have like gone to Marcus III, then come back. Maybe they should have done that. But then you wouldn't have an episode. Or maybe you would have.
Yeah, but by the way, what is space normal speed, my friend?
Oh, that's called Star Trek making stuff up, but it means less than warp speed. Everyone always, what is space normal speed? It's just less than warp speed. Now, I mean, full impulse is technically a quarter of the speed of light. So they're going slower than that. So, that's just TV magic. But the real meat of this story is Spock's logic and inability to understand the panic of his human compatriots and to kind of make people, rise to the cause or give them confidence that everything's going to be okay. I think that's the real meat of it. He keeps citing to logic. He thinks if I show my weapons, logically, these wild animal 11-foot-tall monsters will back off. That didn't happen. And if I show logic and calm to the crew, they'll understand what I'm doing and they'll back off. But that's not
I mean, ultimately, it works out because logic wins. He says, all right, just get us into orbit and send out a flare.
Well, he didn't actually say anything. He, at the end, jokes, he reasoned it was time to panic. So that's what he did. But even before you get there, we got our first death is, I think that's actually pretty funny, is that because that's Latimer, if you freeze it, it looks like he's being crucified when he gets stabbed by that really long spear. Yeah. It's actually kind of humorous the way he falls. So he was covered in mist because, again, standards and practices didn't want to see a body. But I also like that, like, kind of scientific at the end. Like, oh, look at this. It's a fulsome point. They've really mastered this. And then Bulma calls out Spock saying, a fulsome point. You got a dead guy you're standing on top of, and you got blood on the spear, and you're only curious about the fulsome point? Well, it's fascinating. No, it isn't. We got to do something. But then he leaves Gaetano out there saying, just guard the place. You'll be fine. I don't know. Would you have made that choice? Maybe. What do you think?
Would I have made which choice?
Would you have left Gaetano out in the middle of nowhere with one phaser standing by himself?
Yeah, man. The guy's a Starfleet officer. He's elite, and he's got a laser gun.
Mm-hmm.
Come on.
Phaser, not laser. Like, oh my god.
I know. It's a phaser. It's like a laser gun. We can vaporize anything he sees. So those beams do seem to move slower than a spear.
Well, I do like the fact that they like the sound. Those are actually cool sound effects for the phasers. This has always interested me and makes Star Trek stand out from other things. But the one thing that they don't have is fuel. But draining the phasers makes me wonder, what is a phaser actually powered by? It's not a laser. Is it a plasma weapon? Because they're able to drain it into the ship to take off. I think that's a fascinating, like, scientific little thing there. I don't know. I just they have to drain the whatever's inside it to give them gas to take off. I think that's a fascinating little scientific thing. Did you have any opinion on that, or do you think that was weird?
No, not weird. I mean, whatever. It's got to have a power source like anything else.
Yep. And then they electrify the hull. You got the paper
machine. That was fun. That I like was that. Fun.
Yeah. It's kind of bizarre watching that guy in the back taking the rock and smashing the cramp out of the Galileo.
See, I thought that the giant effect looked pretty good. I don't know if I assume they did some manner of force perspective.
Yes.
But I'm like, what's not to like?
Yeah, I also like this. I even like the spears. But, you know, if you look at it on a standard definition television, it doesn't look as bad as it does in high def remastered. But you know what? You got to give the show a break. It's pretty darn good. It's believable that they are being attacked by a primitive group of people.
Yes.
There's a couple other things I just want to mention is that you see a character here that appears later when they, on the Enterprise, when they launch the Columbus, which is the second shuttlecraft. So you got Columbus and Galileo. How exploratory. On one of the beam down parties, when they come back and he looks like he's had the crap beat out of him. In fact, one of the members is killed. That's Lieutenant Kellowitz. We again see him later in the episode called Arena. That's two episodes from now. But so there is some continuity of characters going on. I did like the... Go on.
Yeah, I liked him. I thought he was really cool, too. I liked that there was this little side mission that we didn't get to see. But, you know, it shows that there are stakes. And it shows that they're not just sitting around idly, that they're sending people down to do exploration, to try to do it. And, in fact, there's so much story, you don't even get to see all of it.
That's quite true. You want to know what the other people are running into. Also, you want to know, it's at the end, you want to know, did they make it okay? And obviously, they most of them do come back. And then we come towards, as we're getting towards the end, we get to them taking off. They're actually, as they're about to take off, there's something that hits the shuttle. They all, like, lean to the right, a rock was thrown at them again. But when they take off, they're being held down, they use their boosters. But as Scotty points out, if we do that, we won't really have enough time for orbit. And they make it into orbit, and that's where we come to the biggest chance Spock ever takes under his command, which he does admit earlier he doesn't want. But what do you think of that? His gambit at that last moment?
I loved it, and it really actually reminds me that I've never seen Spock. This is the first time, and I've not watched original TOS. It's been very rare that I saw Spock act as a captain, as an executive officer, making decisions on his own, and not just merely carrying out Kirk's decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, the only other time that I can think of is in my favorite, The Undiscovered Country, when he's doing the investigation on the Enterprise for the gravity boots. You know, it's the good whodunit.
That's true.
He's great. He's an amazing, he's an excellent, excellent captain. And quick aside, I also like, I don't know if they had established this in the lore yet, that Vulcans are stronger than humans. When he picks up the dead corpse of one of the folks who gets killed by the spears, he looks pretty nonchalant about it. It's like, oh yeah, that looks like a guy who's strong, who's acting at least stronger than the average human. I guess that Nimoy was just kind of jacked, despite being a skinny guy.
Yeah, that's true. He was. Well, they're all kind of jacked, honestly. But yeah, he's a strong guy. I mean, there's nothing in the backgrounds that says, yeah, he deadlifted 500 pounds. But you know, you can probably
physically fit man.
Prison.
And but he didn't wobble at all. And I guess the guy was kind of small. But I did love the igniting the plasma, talking about Echoes of Future Trek. Wesley with his harebrained maneuver when he ignites the plasma with the other not Tom Paris idiots at Starfleet. And it also reminded me, once or twice, Geordi was able to see some sort of beacon that no one else could. That's because true. Of his visor. His
visor, right. That was the one where he's trapped on Galandrin Kor with a Romulan. Yeah, that one. But I do like the fact that they use it. They're on all the entire crew. It's like, what in God's name are you doing? You're sending us all to death. But Scotty realizes, a signal flare. I gotcha.
Yeah.
I like the fact that he reasons it out. But Spock is like, panic, no one's going to be there. And everyone says, I don't want to die up here. But as they're falling to their deaths with dignity, that's when Kirk, or actually Sulu, notices, Captain, there's something behind us. And they see that green line, at least in the remastered version, which is the fuel burning. And then they are able to focus on beaming them back. And that's how they get out of there. And you see the shuttlecraft falling to its demise. I like that entire last sequence. It's one of some of the best. An interesting or a fascinating thing is the next time you see the shuttlecraft Galileo, it says Galileo 2 on it. So I like the fact that they do that.
So, oh yeah, Matt, tell me, what do you did? Is there ever an explanation for why the shuttlecrafts in this one and throughout all of Trek have that kind of red script,
as opposed to just
some sort of
the racing stripe the on line? The side? Because it looks cool.
No. The red like the name of it is in script. It's in cursive.
Yeah, that's. I guess it's trying to be like a World War II craft, like a bomber, where they have their names on it. Some of them were print. Some of them are in script. That's the only reason I can think of. It's just a stylistic choice.
Gotcha.
One other thing that's on the side of the shuttlecraft, if you look at it on the stills, it says it's 1701/7. So that means that there's six other craft on board the Enterprise, probably. But I like that entire hangar deck. I like that where you got like the overhang.
Oh, yeah.
People looking down. And you saw it really briefly in Conscience of the King. They're just walking on the catwalk, which is, I guess, all the way towards the back. But that's one of my favorite sets. It's just like, wow, how big is this ship? It's got a garage for at least, well, you know, seven at minimum. It's really cool. It's a good one. I don't know what else there is to bring up on this. I mean, we were
the one little bad note, though, that silly all of them laughing awkwardly at the end. What a horrible day on set. It's like, all right, keep laughing.
I would accidentally, on purpose, cut that out. Because up to that point, Kirk says, so you reasoned that you were okay to panic. And yes is the answer. That last line is fine, but that fake laughter, that's like they're making fun of Spock. I agree with you. I don't think that's appropriate, but I understand.
Not only that, problematic that it's like, so you guys aren't too beat up about losing two crewmen, huh? I guess it's just another day ending in Y here?
Not just those two. You have also the loss of the crewmen on the landing parties, and not just one. It's plural. Well, you know, we only have
30
dead, man. It's okay.
Got to break some eggs. Yeah, I mean, this is what did you, you've read Red Shirts by John Scalzi.
Yes, I have.
It's like, that's the thing, man. You got to stay out of the canon.
Yeah.
Stay in the lower decks.
That's right.
Speaking of which, Lower Decks canceled, as I'm sure you might have heard.
Yes, that's just right now. I'm not upset about it. The show should have been called Reference-O-Rama because it just references shows. Some other things that this film is, besides that 1939 movie with Lucille Ball, this also reminds me a little bit. Does anyone ever see the movie Heavy Metal? I think it's the 1979 cartoon. Or
Yes. Animated anthology. Yes.
There's that scene where the bomber pilot crashes on the island of zombies. That kind of reminded me of that.
Oh man, you know, I only saw that once years ago. I don't quite remember it. I really just remember the cab driver.
Well, you know what? That's what the Fifth Element's based on. I could see a future yelling at Gaseous Anomalies special edition. I'm just talking about heavy metal. But there's also another film called Flight of the Phoenix from 1965, starring James
Stewart. Oh, yeah, I love Flight of the Phoenix.
Yep. That one. Yeah.
And also, Naked Gun reference.
Yes, there is also a Naked Gun reference. There you go. But
the actor, I can't, George something.
Yep, there's also Richard Attenborough in it, you know.
Yes.
In a bizarre, and I'm going to mention it today while folding the laundry, North by Northwest was on, one of my favorite films. So he's in that as well. But
love North by Northwest.
North by Northwest, love that film.
Yes, I know. You know, one of the main reasons I love that film is Cary Grant. Any other person would be paralyzed with terror. He's just, it's like he was the right person for something very inconvenient to happen to, because he's taken everything in real stride.
Yeah, he's the ultimate of Mr. Cool. And also, since I have worked at the United Nations, I can almost with authority say that I don't think the furniture has changed in style or look since the 1950s.
But wait, when did you work at the United Nations?
Sorry. I worked at the United Nations back in a mythical time called the 90s as a computer teacher. I was a computer teacher. Oh. Yeah, but that's a story for another day. And it has nothing to do with Star Trek, though. Although, I feel like it did, with rooms filled with screens. But, yeah, I think that's pretty much it for this one. I think this is smiles all around for this episode. Right, Mike?
Yes, sir. I can give my rating, or would you like to go first?
Well, let's actually first. Do you have a WTF moment in this? Because I actually don't have one. Well, I sort of have one. I can give you my only real WTF moment, or two of them in there, which is one is the
cape. No.
I have two.
Go on.
One is the cape on the back of Commissioner Ferris's.
I like that cape.
Drives me nuts. And also, every time Yeoman Mears does something, she always winds up like jumping out of her chair on her knees. It's a couple.
I mean, she looked great.
Yeah, but it's a little silly.
She looked beautiful.
It's like, what, you don't know about
it? It is
chairs?
A little silly, but she's wearing some nice stockings. My goodness, what a catch.
Well, that's what, you know, stockings in space. That's a rule, I think.
Hey, man, it gets cold there.
Yeah, that's what I hear. But do you have a WTF moment in this or no?
No, I mean, you know, the Giants never getting an explanation and the gigantic asparagus-looking spear. But no, I mean, whatever, it's part of the plot. I wouldn't dare say it's a WTF. Just, I wish they had said a little bit. I mean, again, you could have maybe cut out one of the scenes with of them talking about, hey, we have to go on time with, you know, someone maybe possibly making first initial contact and discussing speaking with the Giants, possibly, but whatever. Mm-hmm. Monday morning quarterbacking.
Yeah, that's
whatever.
Right. Well, Nimoy really loved this episode. He thought it was a big step in the evolution of Spock, and he even had a quote that it was that his character was a very human character dealing with a very human problem. And his quote is, "We're all living our lives trying to find a balance between emotion and logic. I think for that reason, audiences identified with Spock." And I have to agree. You know, you do have those issues in life where you can't sometimes make a decision, or you're acting on one way and versus another, balancing your own emotions against emotional things. But now let's go to our final ratings. You go first on our very scientific 1 to 10 scale. What are you going to give the Galileo 7?
I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10.
Really?
It was great. The only reason I'm not giving it higher is just because I feel like there's better things to come so far, and that it was, you know, a great story, but pretty straightforward. It was an excellent story, and way better than Shore Leave and Mary and all that other crap. I'm glad that we're back into the swing of things, and it was, again, it feels like real Trek. Like, this could have been a script that TNG had done, or DS9. By the way, where in the shooting order was this?
This was actually 14th, or in the shooting order, and it aired, exactly where we're seeing it right now. It is, hold on, let me get to that. It was actually filmed 14th, and it was shown Well, right after right after Balance of Terror, so it's about the same spot. So look at that. It's actually pretty good. It was a very expensive show with all the effects, believe it or not, the space effects and the shuttlecraft. It almost lost its slot for 1966, 1967. But it was a lot of fun for my rating. Do you have anything else you want? Any other questions on that? Or I'm going to give my rating.
No.
Now, my rating, I'm going to...
Oh, go ahead, sir.
I'm going to agree with you. I'm going to give it an 8.5, 8 to 9. I enjoy this one a lot. It is very straightforward. There's really not anything that I can really find fault with it, except maybe go do your medical job first and then come back and explore. But I really enjoy it. I like the fact that the characterizations of Spock, you get to see a little bit more into his thinking and dealing with his very irrational human compatriots. And I like the fact that it didn't only center on Kirk. It did center on the other portions of the crew, which was actually a nice and refreshing change. But so 8 to 8.5 out of for me and 8 for Mike. And yeah, that was a really great episode. So
A plus, everyone. Go check it out. I mean, A minus, but still, that's just comparatively. That's with a curve.
That's true. So that brings us again to another close of Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. Anything else you want to add, Mike, besides you're looking forward to the next episode?
Looking forward. Tell us a little bit, at least the name of.
The next episode is The Squire of Gothos. It's an interesting romp, which I'm dying to hear what you think, because I can hear your TNG alarms going off, and that's all I will say.
The Esquire of Gothos, huh?
Yeah, not the Esquire. It's not a law procedural. Yes, but that's the next episode on Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies, and we hope you all come and join us on that. Remember, if you like what we're doing, please feel free to contact us at yellingatgas@gmail.com. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe, and we'll see you on the next episode of Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. So everyone, listen, you all have a good night, and we'll see you on the next one. Mike, as always, live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper, Captain. Thank you. Have a good night.
Have a good night. See you next time, everyone.